Welcome to Trillions. I'm Joel Weber.
And I'm Eric Balchunas.
So we have a guest, Eric.
We do.
You brought him.
Yeah, I believe this is, well, we've had an issuer on before, but this is our first big time, big company issuer.
You're kind of a big deal.
Yeah, I mean, everybody knows this company.
What company is it?
Fidelity.
And who is he?
Matt Goulet, who is an ETF industry veteran. Remember when we did Inside ETFs? We talked to Brian Lake, who was at JP Morgan, but he had been in other areas. There was a trend, and it still goes on. A lot of companies that are massive mutual fund companies get into the ETF space. They got to hire people who know what they're doing. So they go to BlackRock and State Street, and they hire them away, and they run. They start to build up their brand, and Matt is one of those guys.
He's like Fidelity's ETF guy.
Yeah, he's kind of like the ETF entrepreneur inside this massive company that everybody knows, and I think they're a household name, to say the least. People use it as their brokerage platform, or they have funds. And I remember as a reporter when I first started out at Institutional Investor, covering mutual fund companies for Fund Action, which is one of the newsletters at II. And back then, this is the late 90s, mid-90s, Fidelity was the king of the hill. I mean, Vanguard was something you covered occasionally. They've since grown big. Fidelity is still big. But now you have this new world where passive has risen up to a huge extent, right? A lot of them, almost all the money's going there. And you have firms like Fidelity making their imprint in this world. And I think not only are they representative from an industry standpoint of it's almost like merging into this new technology, but from an investor standpoint, somebody who's worked in the ETF industry works in Fidelity, and there's all these structures and a lot of them get used together. It's just an interesting way to look at he kind of sits at the crossroads of a couple things happening at the same time.
So he's like the little fish in a big pond making a big difference.
Yeah, I was trying to think of another way to throw a big on there, but yeah,
we'll go with it.
Yeah, you win.
All right. This episode, Matt Goulet of Fidelity. All right, Matt, we just described you. How would you describe yourself?
That's a pretty lofty description and background you gave on me. Thanks. I remember 10 years ago when Eric was the Bloomberg consultant, and I was at Spider ETFs and couldn't figure out how to turn on my computer, and he would show me how to use Bloomberg for the first time. So I guess we've come a long way.
Did he help you turn on your computer?
I told you, I was the Walmart manager of the data, and sometimes they'd send me to aisle four to help a client pick the jelly.
On aisle four?
Yeah, clean up on aisle four.
So my first job was...
Matt doesn't know how to log in.
This is before AI, before robotics or anything like that. My first job at Spider ETFs was aggregating news. We sent out a weekly email called the Chatterbox, and it was this big deal if a blogger would talk about ETFs, and now you read about them in the Wall Street Journal.
So how did you get that job at Spider?
Luck, chance.
Yeah.
Kind of fell into it.
How did you find the ETF?
I think growing up in Boston, it was more of who are the major employers in financial services. Knew I wanted to do financial services. I remember getting a call from a family friend and saying, look, there's this small division within State Street Global Advisors that's working on ETFs. Might be something worth looking into. Got introduced to Dodd Kitsley, who I know you know, Eric, and the rest is history, I guess.
History already? was like a decade ago.
Let me ask you this question, because I remember when I covered ETFs, we covered this a couple of weeks ago, there's like a light bulb moment where you're like, damn, this thing is like five evolutionary steps beyond other structures. It's going to be a big deal. Did you have that moment at Spider, and how fast did it happen?
Totally. It was probably year two or year three. I knew I was into something special and knew there was growth. And I think the big evolution for me in my career anyways is that at the time we thought about financial advisors, we thought about institutions. It was really cool to think about hedge fund utilization and pensions using ETFs. Now in the seat I'm in, working at Fidelity, I think the thing that excites me most is mainstream America. And we'll get into this a little bit later in the show, but it's just very, very early in terms of retail households using ETFs.
Were you at Spider when they launched GLD?
No. It was a couple months before my time, but it was there for JNK and a lot of the fixed income ETFs.
The controversial JNK.
What was the launch that made you go, whoa?
It was probably some of the fixed income. It was some of the high yield, some of the municipal bond ETFs. There were two issuers at the same time launching products a week apart, and it was a race to who could get to 100 million first. But that was the time it felt real to me. And you mentioned GLD. I think those are the funniest phone calls we got in those days, is every other phone call you would get from a client was, is the gold really in the vault?
Is it though? I'm going to a vault. We got to get in.
We've been trying to get somebody in a vault to interview the gold for a couple months now. So if anybody out there is listening who can get us into, there's like 20 gold funds at this point.
We're coming for you.
Yeah, we really want to get
in. We want to see your gold.
Yeah, we want to see the man with the machine gun guarding it. And just
Eric keeps saying that. Yeah, I just want to see the gold.
Yeah. No, I want to talk to the guard.
They might put a mask over your head, you know, when they drive
I'll
you
do
to the place.
I'll do it. I'll put the bag over my head, drive me around the city. I don't care where I get out. Well, I mean, I want to come home, but.
I get that question. I don't even work at Spider or any of the gold places. Right. I get that question a lot when I go on the road to do presentations. People want to know if the gold's really there. It's a top five question. So,
what are the top five questions that you get?
Today in the current role?
Yeah. Which is what, by the way? What's your job?
Yeah, so current job at Fidelity is ETF guy, as Eric put it, or one of you put it. But really, it's educating our financial advisors on our platform and in the industry and retail investors on how to use ETFs. So in some ways, we're running the same playbook we ran 5 years ago, 10 years ago, ETF education, how to use them. That's really the role right now is ETF education. And then the role of Fidelity products in that, right? So in the last 4 years, we've launched over 20 products. Every time we launch a new product, we spend a lot of time with our client-facing teams, educating them on the product, how it works.
How many products have you sunsetted if you've launched that many?
Zero.
Really?
Zero.
So 100% new?
Yeah, going back to 2003 when we launched OneQ, we haven't closed an ETF mm-hmm. as of yet.
So what's the number one question that people ask you?
Number one question today? I think most of the questions we're still getting are around trading, right? Best practices. And that's not just advisors, that's retail investors. So if you think about the client experience, the customer experience, that's something we're thinking about all the time. If someone's interacting on Fidelity.com or on their trading portal, what does it look like? And you know this, is ETFs still sit kind of within the stock framework. So you put up a trade ticket and it'll say market order versus limit order. For someone who's only ever bought a mutual fund, that can be something that you have to walk through with them. So that's probably the number one question we get in the retail space is how do you trade ETFs? What are best practices for trading ETFs?
And how do you respond to that?
We always encourage people to consider limit orders, right? So if an ETF and you're putting a market order out there, that can lead to a suboptimal outcome for trading execution. So we encourage folks to look at limit orders, to think about what's trading the overall market and just to be thoughtful about their approach for trading ETFs.
Let's just break this down because I think there's some people who are like, what's a market limit order? Can you talk about...
Break it down.
Your DJ mix sound sounded, your scratching sounded exactly like your
squeaky wheel
at the supermarket.
They're very
just
similar.
FYI.
They're very similar.
Yeah, you got to work.
They're cousins.
I take that one back to the
lab. It's a transition moment.
Okay. All right. Limit orders, you know, as an analyst, we're always told to just default to limit order, but you have access to some of the data that people are using on your platform. What's the breakdown between people using market orders and limit orders? And it just go through what each is.
Sure. So market order is the majority of the client orders we see. And I think most people in the ETF space, that could be alarming, right? And it's close to 70% of our orders are market orders. But for the overwhelming majority of ETFs that trade millions, if not billions of a day, that's not a big problem. Limit orders are the minority. Limit order is you're setting a price, but you don't know at what time it'll execute. Market order is a little bit of the inverse of that. So you want it executed now. You want it executed at the best price available now. And you're willing to sacrifice price for time.
Now, in that case, right, let's say it's a big liquid one like IVV or JNK or something like we mentioned, or GLD. Is there a case where market order just makes more sense? Because it's so liquid, it'll just digest the order and you'll get a good deal. Is there a point where if it doesn't trade a certain amount, then you should go limit order because the spreads are wider? And if you put a limit order in, it's likely you could save a few basis points on that.
Right.
How would you work that out?
Yeah, it's kind of like when you're crossing the street of three young kids and you tell them to cross the street and look both ways. When do you tell them to look both ways before they cross the street? For us in the ETF market, it's probably 20% of volume, right? If your trade order represents 20% of what that ETF trades in a given day, you want to at least stop, look to the left, look to the right, think about what you're doing. That's a general rule of thumb we use for kind of trade order guidance.
But let's say I'm trading one of your lesser liquid products like the high dividend ETF and it trades 5,000 shares a day or something. Would you tell me to put a limit order in always, or can you do a market order on something?
No, not necessarily.
Like that?
I think if you're a retail client and time is important to you and you want that trade done at 10 a.m. versus 2 p.m. in the afternoon, market order is your option.
So one of the things, though, in general about ETFs and the knock is that, you know, they really facilitate trading, right? I can sit there all day and just day trade as a retail investor, and maybe that's not the best thing for me. Right. So how do you guys talk about that with clients?
Yeah, I think that's a little bit of a myth out there. Certainly there's active traders, and out of the 9 million households we have on the platform, we have about 1 million of those 9 million households. They're using ETFs in some way, shape, or form. Of that 1 million, it's a relatively small majority of day traders and active traders. Many of the people using ETFs now are buy and hold investors. We ran some analysis, I think it was 2 years ago, that looked at holding periods. And the holding periods were up close to 2 years for the average ETF position. And you think about, we're launching new products as an industry every day. The industry's growing. That holding period was roughly in line with what you see with mutual funds. And I don't have the data at my fingertips. But the point is that it's not as if, because we're giving people trading access intraday, that they're trading it all the time. And you look back on a kind of historical basis, if you might remember this, but 401ks used to be monthly. They weren't daily. And the question was, well, if you give people daily access to their 401k, are they going to trade it every day? And the answer generally is no. People are long buy and hold investors.
Of that data you just talked about,
sure,
and households, is that regarding just your ETFs or all the ETFs they could buy on your platform?
No, that's all the ETFs. And that's okay. What gets me so excited about the space. So when I gave those stats before, there's 9 million households on the Fidelity brokerage platform, roughly. About 1 million of them use any ETF, not just a Fidelity ETF, but any ETF. So 11% of the population. But within that, and we were going over your history before, prior to Bloomberg, you were at where? Institutional Investor, or another publication.
I had two jobs before that, but my first job out of school was Institutional Investor's newsletter division.
So, did you have the gelled up hair then?
I did. Yeah.
Yeah. First job?
Yeah. I had my depth going hard. I was like a 21-year-old in New York City, living in Manhattan. Yeah. I mean, I'm still catching up on sleep.
I didn't mean to go down this path, but my point was, I presume they paid you at the time, and I presume you had a 401k, and maybe you rolled it over into an IRA. And maybe that money just sat there forever, and you didn't really play with it, and now you're making the big bucks at Bloomberg, so you're investing in other things. My point there is that if client accounts underneath $100,000, only 11% across the board own ETFs. But I started to look at client accounts that are over $100,000. So people who are probably spending some time looking at their investments, and that's where it gets really interesting, is on the whole of client accounts that are over $100,000, millennials are really driving this. 40% of millennial accounts with over $100,000 own an ETF. That's much more than Gen X. That's much more than baby boomers. They're going to be the ones that are driving this. And of those millennials that hold ETFs on our platform, if you hold an ETF, it represents 26% of your assets. So I think as you see some of the baby boomers retire and decumulate assets, millennials driving the growth of the industry, that's what I'm really excited about.
Are you a millennial?
What's the cutoff? 80?
It's kind of like 80, 81 is sort of which...
I am a millennial.
Yeah, okay.
He's got some Gen X in him, though. I can just tell. He's not full-blown.
You're giving him permission?
Yeah.
I look like a Gen Xer.
Do you remember when Nirvana came out?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you can't be full millennial if you have some inkling
full
of
millennial,
that.
I like
yeah.
that. So you're like maybe half millennial.
like you're millennial if your first rock band was like The Strokes.
That's not me.
Okay, there you go.
Okay, so why is there so much enthusiasm with millennials from your perspective?
I think they're still learning about it, but they view ETFs as lower cost, as more tax efficient. I think the interesting thing about ETFs is there's not one reason that someone buys an ETF. It's a whole host of reasons. It could be lower cost, could be intraday trading, could be any of that. And I think they're being introduced to it by a lot of the robo-advisors, by a lot of the digital platforms that are using ETFs. So if an ETF shows up in your managed account, let's say, that's going to be the first product that you kind of grow up using. And I think that's what a lot of millennials are using, is they're using different applications and different sources for investing.
So you have 1 million of your 9 million people using your platform that use ETFs in some way.
That's right.
I mean, where are we looking at this number in, say, 10 years? Let's just even go 20, because you're talking about baby boomers eventually passing on assets and
sure.
Millennials clearly like this structure. I mean, have you done any projections? Is this going to be like 7 out of 9 or all 9? I mean, how big is it going to get?
One of your podcasts recently, somebody was projecting $30 trillion. I don't think I'd be that bold on the next 10 years. It might have been...
That was 30 by 30.
30
or
by 30.
2030, yeah, 30 trillion by 30.
Yeah.
A lot of that is market cap accumulation of the stock
right.
markets, but it's still definitely ambitious.
Well,
let's
go back in time. I mean, I don't have any projections for you, but I think a historical perspective is interesting here, right?
That was a time warp.
All the sound effects in the studio are great here.
I just think he watched Police Academy way too much. Remember that sound effects guy?
Yeah,
yeah, he was highly inspired.
Okay, so we went back in time.
So we go back in time. We're in the 80s. We're when the millennials are being born.
This is Eric's like
sweet spot.
Yeah.
Cultural references galore. So ICI looks at what percent of Americans held mutual funds every year, and they go back to the 80s. And you think about 1980, that's when mutual funds first started showing up in 401k plans. And the percent of American households that held mutual funds in the late 1980s was about 20%. And that's kind of where we're at now, right? So I said millennials, 40% of the moment, but in the masses, it's about 20%. So think about the growth of ETFs. We're kind of in the year 1986, 1987 in terms of the growth trajectory. And then think about how quickly mutual funds grew in the 90s. Hmm. And that's what's ahead of us for ETFs.
Okay, so Matt, one of the things I'm really interested about is how Fidelity, which really created its name through actively managed mutual funds, has in recent decades adopted ETFs. So what's that like culturally inside Fidelity?
I think it's a really exciting time. If you think about the masses of investment professionals and analysts and portfolio managers we have, they're excited about this ETF initiative. For us, it's just a different delivery mechanism. It's a different structure to do what we're already doing on a daily basis in a mutual fund or in a managed account or in a CIT. And I'll give you an example. You know this, but I 2 years ago, we launched factor ETFs. These are Fidelity ETFs that track a Fidelity index. That index was built by our product team and our quantitative team. That quant team sits with active portfolio managers on a daily basis, managing risk and helping pick stocks. So active is very much in our DNA. We believe in active management. It's just being built in a different structure and in a different delivery mechanism for consumers.
So we talk a lot about these ETFs and how to make a portfolio, because ultimately that's what you're trying to do. These are the raw materials you put into a portfolio. Is the portfolio changing? Is it becoming more of like, instead of having your core equity be a large cap growth fund or a value fund or large cap blend, it's now like a cheap S&P 500 ETF, and then you keep your core real passive and cheap, and then you kind of go on the outside with your active. Do you see a shift that the active manager will be much more on the outside, used as we like to say, like hot sauce or spice on top to try to get some alpha, which would allow the investor more patience to hang in there with some underperformance? It would allow them to get more active share. Do you see a shift in what active is used for and how it's used in a portfolio?
Maybe. I mean, certainly you've seen a number of factor products come into the marketplace, and that's a little bit of active, but I don't necessarily see that. I think a good example is FBND, our total bond ETF. That portfolio management team led by Ford O'Neill, they've been running a mutual fund version of that. It's not exactly a clone, but it's similar for years. And we're just delivering that in the ETF structure, but we're running it very similar to what we run in the mutual fund. So we're not changing our fundamental investment process, our bottoms-up research. We're just delivering it in a different structure. So I don't know if that could be the case in certain areas, but it's not fundamentally changing the way we manage money.
And what about how people are managing their own money? Because, I mean, we were just talking about the mutual fund growth from the 80s, 90s. Like, one of the reasons that it took off was that, you know, you guys have a platform that is my 401k, and my 401k auto fills every pay period into that account, right? But yet ETFs are barely in that device yet, right?
In the 401k.
Yeah. So,
that's right.
So how do you guys see that evolving?
Yeah, so specifically ETFs within 401ks, you do see them from time to time. You see them in self-directed brokerage accounts, which many 401k plans offer. What's kind of interesting is you actually see ETFs show up in IRAs, which are non-taxable for most people. So it's not as if people are only using them for their tax efficiency. The 401k question's been out there for a while. I think it's operational. I think it's just that clients probably don't need the intraday liquidity like they do with maybe their taxable account. But the way we're interacting with investors on the platform, if you will, and that was kind of your original question, is we're giving them choice and we're giving them value, right? So on our platform, most ETFs, all 1,500, 1,900, whatever we're at today, are available for trading. We offer 93 of those ETFs commission-free. So we're offering the clients commission-free trading in some iShares ETFs and some Fidelity ETFs. And also, if they want passive, it's not all about an ETF, and you know this, but there's passive mutual funds. So we offer low-cost passive mutual funds to investors, and we give choice between the actual structure.
Which leads me to something I saw recently. There was an advertisement that someone tweeted out that I can't remember the makeup, but it basically was Fidelity saying, hey, forget Vanguard. We're really the low-cost provider in the index mutual fund space. I think yours are like 0.01 or 0.02% for an index mutual fund. So they've sort of vanguarded Vanguard, if you will. And that works, right? You see flows when you go cheaper.
Yeah, I don't think it's about a specific competitor. There's a number of competitors out there that offer low-cost index products, but I
Wait
think
a minute,
you,
not about Vanguard. That was, dude, that was amazing.
Nice dodge.
No, but
he was told not to talk about the... a lot of these issuers can't say the V word. Yeah. It's like Voldemort.
No, you saw the advertisement. The name was in the advertisement.
He hasn't said it yet.
He won't. He won't do it.
Look, the competitor you just mentioned, Eric,
the Valley Forge-based competitor.
In 28 out of 29 chances where we have index funds and ETFs that go head-to-head roughly, Fidelity has a lower-cost product.
Think about this. World has turned.
That's huge.
Yeah. You also talked about commission-free trading. Now, this drives a lot of flows. Yes, you get your trade commission-free, but if you trade an ETF that has a commission, it's not that much. Go over the differences in cost. And the second thing is, are the commission-free ones sometimes the one the issuers are looking to promote? And they might not be the most liquid or ones that people want. And talk about that and how that draws flows and trading.
Absolutely. It's a great question and something I wish investors and advisors were looking at more closely. There's a number of different custodians and brokerage sites out there. We've been deliberate in the way we've manicured our commission-free list to make products that are best in breed or what we feel are best in breed. And that means low cost. That means good secondary market volume. We don't see that across the board. There's a number of commission-free products on other platforms that might actually have higher expense ratios, wider bid-ask spreads, things like that. So that's definitely something to watch out for is I would never advocate for somebody that you buy an ETF strictly because it's commission-free and you save $5. There's a whole boatload of costs that go into that. And depending on the trade size, right, the more you're trading in dollars, the less that $5 matters. And the smaller the inverse.
And that's a one-time cost that dilutes over time, whereas the expense ratio
Absolutely.
is coming rain or shine every day.
Termites. Always yeah. coming, man.
Yeah. They're my metaphor is the expense ratio is like termites living in your returns. They're not going away. They just live
and what's
there.
Whereas, the commission?
Well, that's sort of like a round-trip ticket. Like, you know, you buy it and then you sell it. It's a one-time. It's almost like a tiny, tiny load if you think of the mutual fund model or a, you know, like I said, a round-trip ticket
cost. I was looking for another termite analogy. That's what I was getting.
Yeah. Sorry. That's my one. The termite one is it kind of works, though, because if the expense ratio is small, it just limits the amount that nibbles away at the return. Not that you can't outperform if you're active, but that expense is truly something that comes. And some people don't realize that the expense ratio is taken out in tiny little bits every day. It's not like once a year, and that is why the termite metaphor. It's just nibbling a little bit each day, prorated at the annual cost.
But I think you're right. There's parallels to mutual fund land, right? In mutual fund land, we talk about surcharges or transaction fees. In ETF land, because it's a brokerage product and trades in the stock exchange, it's a commission. But you're right. Some of these costs are analogous, and it just begs for more tools and more research and screener tools. So there's some really great comparison tools out there. I know Bloomberg has some, Fidelity has some, but these are the costs you need to be looking at to create this total cost framework of the bid-ask spread, the commission, the expense ratio, and the tax cost, if that matters to you.
So talk to me about being an issuer. That seems like a really big deal. And specifically, though, where's the white space that you guys see right now?
So as an issuer, so we've talked about Fidelity as a platform, and now we're talking about Fidelity as an issuer. As an issuer, 5 years ago, I think we were maybe outside the top 20. Now we're number 15 or number 16, and I think you were sharing with me yesterday.
I just looked at the numbers. They're number 16. They're the 16th biggest issuer. Mm-hmm. They came out of nowhere. They're 5 years old. They had that one from the 2003, but let's just not count that. Mostly their big effort was 5 years old. They have $10 billion. However, 16th place in ETF land only gives you 0.3% market share. Because it's a lot of concentration at the top, but look, they're passing.
It's a quiet march.
Yeah,
I don't know if it's a quiet march, but I think the point is we're growing. We're taking market share. We're top 10 inflows year to date, so continuing to move up the ladder. And the white space, to get to your question, is the retail investor. I'm convinced of that. I'm convinced that there are still advisors out there who don't use ETFs, but there's masses of retail investors that have not been introduced to ETFs yet, and that is the white space, I think, in ETF land.
When I look at your ETFs, you kind of have three main components. There's sector ETFs where you came out and you basically, again, you vanguarded the sector category. They charge 0.08%, meaning they came in and they undercut everybody. Those are 85% of your assets. Talk about those. Those track tech, the general sectors. What's the play there? Why, sure. Why would somebody use those?
So those Fidelity sector ETFs, they track MSCI benchmarks, the big, not just the cost, they're the lowest cost sector ETFs in the market. But they also are all cap. And I think that's the key differentiator is having small cap within your portfolio. You look at some of the bigger, we were talking about technology earlier, and technology is a great example, where some of the biggest quote-unquote technology ETFs have AT&T and Verizon, a lot of telecom names in them. They're missing out on some of the mid-cap and smaller-cap names like Twitter and Square and some of these other names. So that's the biggest differentiator for me, is that the mid-cap, the small-cap exposure, and delivering that all commission-free on the Fidelity platform at a basis points to anyone, that's the key differentiator, and I think what's led to the growth of the Fidelity Sector Series over the last few years.
And you guys have sector mutual funds, though.
We do.
And how does that work? I mean, when you're out there trying to sell the sector ETF, does it step on the toes of the mutual fund salespeople?
Not at all. From a client-facing perspective, they're the same people in most cases, right? It's not like we have some rogue organization. And but if you're working
you,
with somebody...
You are the rogue organization.
maybe. Yeah. But absolutely not. They're both growing, right? And I think a great example, and Bloomberg featured our portfolio manager, Charlie Chai, is the PM of our active technology sector fund. And he had one of the better performing mutual funds last year for 2017. Over the last 12 months through Q1, that mutual fund has brought in almost $1 billion. The technology ETF at 8 basis points has brought in almost $1 billion. So they're both growing when active is doing well and doing what it should. The stat I look at, which is kind of the crossover stat, right? So take the people who hold our technology ETF, FTEC, FTEC. There's about 48,000 households there that hold FTEC on the Fidelity platform. Only about 30% of them own any active sector mutual fund at Fidelity whatsoever. My point in giving you that stat is that the majority of our ETF clients are new clients. They're using ETFs for whatever reason. I don't see a lot of people selling the active mutual fund to buy the passive ETF directly, one for one. I think, in fact, the people who are buying the sector ETFs are more likely to buy an index mutual fund than they are to buy one of our active mutual funds. It's just a different client set completely from what I've seen in the data.
So let's talk about the factor ETFs. We just spent last episode talking about factor ETFs and smart beta. And the conversion, like you said, of active into an index. Your factor ETFs, they cover the main areas, quality, value, momentum. These are these areas. Here's what I really want to ask you, which is that if you look at factor ETFs from the different brand, there's a lot of brands out there that have factor ETF lines. Here's an example. The S&P 500 indexes, their value ETF does not hold Apple. In fact, Apple's not in any of their factor ETFs. In Fidelity, Apple makes all of them. But let's just stick to value. Why would Apple be in your value ETF and not in the S&P 500, Sure. Which is tracked by Invesco?
So you bring up a great point, is that when you buy two large cap passive ETFs, whether they're benchmarked to Russell 1000 or S&P 500, they move in line with each other very close. There's very little dispersion between the outcomes. In Factorland, it's all over the place. You can buy two different value ETFs, two different low vol ETFs. They're going to have very different performance based on the underlying methodology. So you asked a question about Apple, and let's dig a little bit into the methodology for Fidelity's factor series. And this applies to all of the single factor ETFs you just mentioned. Our ETFs are sector neutral. They're size neutral, meaning we don't drift down into small cap as many factor products do. And all of the individual security bets are capped. It's called equal active weighting. It's a long way of saying it's relatively constrained to what the eligible universe is, which is the top 1,000 names. So when you go through that approach, it's no surprise that a name like Apple might show up in a value or dividend ETF. Apple today yields 1.5%. It's not like it yields nothing. And we're looking at it within the technology sector, right? So all of our metrics are applied within the technology sector. That's why you might not see it. And I think that might be a rare case where it shows up in all of the ETFs. Some of the other names I was looking at the other day were Amazon. So Amazon can only be found in our momentum ETF. General Electric is
I hope
not
that's
in
not India. Value.
Exactly.
That would be kind of messed up.
But that's my point. I think that would be messed up. It could be messed up. But I mean, Amazon still is consumer discretionary. But my point there was that at the individual stock name, they tell you a story about the individual methodology of each product. And I think Apple's a good example. But there are other examples of individual names that show up where you'd think they should be. The other products that you mentioned, just a quick bullet, I don't know the S&P series too well, but I think when you get unconstrained, you can get some funky things happening, right? So the book value of financial services companies from accounting reasons can be kind of goofy. You could load up on financials in a value ETF just based if you're just looking at price to book value. So we try to constrain these products.
And when you say constrain, yours make sure the sectors are somewhat aligned to the sector weightings of the S&P.
Sector neutral.
Whereas
correct.
The S&P, they don't care. They're just going after it, and their sector, they have no sector bands.
Yeah, I don't know the S&P series as well as I should, but for the Fidelity series, it's not to the S&P, it's to a universe of 1,000 names. But yes, you're on the right track. It's sector neutral to the overall eligible universe. So when you look at a Fidelity factor ETF, a single factor ETF, if technology is 20% of the market, you're going to see likely 20% in technology.
So I got a big meta question, which is, what are people not talking enough about in the ETF space that you think they should be considering?
So I think the common response from ETF issuers there is active, and I certainly believe in active. We've talked about this a little bit already, but the flows have gone from $1 billion a year to $7 billion to $15 billion, and I really feel excited about active management. But one of the trends I'm starting to follow is what I call multi-purpose ETFs. And you think back years ago, and you might remember this, is we always position ETFs as precise. They were precise instruments. You got S&P 500 and nothing else. No small cap, no emerging markets, no surprises. And what I'm seeing now is that investors don't necessarily want that precision in all circumstances. Sometimes they want a multi-purpose ETF. So one example of that that we brought to the market was the Fidelity Dividend ETF for rising rates. It does two things. It's a dividend ETF, but it protects rising rates relative to other dividend ETFs, right? So it's not probably the best vehicle if you're just trying to make a play on rising rates, but it's a dividend ETF that has the rising rates.
Two birds, one stone.
Exactly. And I think that's the trend you're going to see more of is ETFs that do two things, that do three things, that maybe aren't precise as people are used to going back 5 and 10 years, but it's what the marketplace is asking for, and it's what our customers are asking us for.
How dangerous is that?
Not necessarily dangerous from my perspective. I mean, these products are still well diversified across 100 or more names.
But if you get three or four things that these things are doing, like maybe you don't know what you're going to get.
Like the currency hedged, low volatility, income rising rate factory.
With a side of fries.
We haven't brought a product like that to the market.
That's coming down the pike, yeah. I'm sure.
It could be. I don't know. I think it's all about the name and how it's positioned in the marketplace, right? So
fries would be a good ticket.
We'll write that down. Bring that back to our product team. But in the case of FDRR, it's up to us as the issuer to educate people that this is first and foremost a dividend ETF with built-in added methodology features. And it just goes back to the long march for education that we were talking about earlier.
So I think one of the things that's interesting with what's basically happening in the ETF space is it used to be that, you know, like you could have a great idea, enter the space, maybe blow up in both good ways and bad. But like as institutions like Fidelity enter and take over more and more of the market, it does become more institutional. And I'm wondering how you guys see the overall space as all this white space gets kind of gobbled up. What is the space going to look like going forward?
My perspective would be that over the next 5 or 10 years, you'll probably see it won't be as black and white between ETF and mutual fund, between active and passive, and all these nomenclature things we use to describe the space. But I think there'll be a grain in that 5, 10 years from now, it could be structures that come together. It could be how indexes are put together. But people won't be spending as much time thinking about active versus passive. They'll be talking about how to use them both together in a portfolio, how to incorporate factor-based investing. And I don't know if that answers your question,
yeah.
But I think from my perspective, 10 years ago, it was a little bit of ETFs versus mutual funds, uh-huh. Passive versus active. You're starting to see that erode as active has come back in favor a little bit and active managers have entered the space. And I just think that will lead to an overall conversation about portfolio construction.
Right.
I think that's just good for advisors, good for retail
investors.
A
big gray portfolio.
Oatmeal.
Oatmeal.
Yeah.
Just but that's good for you.
Yeah.
Matt Goulet, thanks so much for joining.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to Trillions. Until next time, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal, Bloomberg.com, Apple Podcasts, and wherever else you listen to podcasts. We'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter. I'm at Joel Weber Show. He's at Eric Balchunas. Trillions is produced by Magnus Hendrickson. Francesca Levy is the head of Bloomberg Podcasts. Bye.